This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today we explore two uncommon angles on the histories of World War I and World War II. First, we're joined by historical fiction writer Robert Harris, author of the recently released novel Precipice. The novel explores a true story, the secret relationship between British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith and Venetia Stanley, set against the tumultuous events of World War I. Later, Giles Milton tells us about his book, The Stalin Affair. It's a gripping, fly-on-the-wall account of the uneasy alliance between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin during World War II. Today's conversations weave together themes of political intrigue, unlikely alliances, and the personal connections that shape historical events. Both books reveal how pivotal relationships and secrets influence nations and change the course of history. Let's get started with our conversation with Robert Harris. He's the author of numerous works of fiction and nonfiction. We last spoke with him in 2013 about his historical novel about the Dreyfus Affair, An Officer and a Spy. Harris's new novel, Precipice, is about romantic obsession, how the privileged escape accountability, and about the little-known history of one of the most consequential women in British history, as Harris calls her. Robert Harris, it's been a while, but welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Nice to be back, Francesca.
This latest book of yours, Precipice, centers around the affair between true characters, Venetia Stanley and Herbert Asquith, who was Prime Minister of the UK as the First World War gets underway. And I think Precipice is, as a title, certainly describes being on the precipice of that conflict. But is there a double meaning to that title?
Yes, I think so. This pair of real-life characters stood on a kind of precipice themselves. They'd been having an affair for, well, we can't be certain absolutely when it started, but it probably been going on for about a year by the summer of 1914. And as the war began, so the Prime Minister Asquith became more and more obsessed with Venetia. He was 61 and she was 26. And it began to be dangerous for them both, I think. And they stood, their affair, their relationship stood on the edge of a precipice of being exposed and of being very dangerous for the security of the country.
And what drew you to this story?
Well, I think it's a phenomenal story, actually. There are, in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, there are 560 letters from Asquith to Venetia. Sometimes he wrote to her three or four times a day. She kept all his letters. They're very passionate, and they're full of military and political secrets, quite astonishing treasure trove. And she must have written him at least 300 letters in return, but he burned all hers just before he ceased to be Prime Minister. So we only have one side of the affair. And I thought one of the things that a historical novelist can do actually is bring alive a character who's otherwise quite silent. And that's what I set out to do, to write a novel with a central female character who really existed and who was very important in the political life of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, say more about that. You in fact, call her in the historical note that you write at the end of the book. You say that she was one of the most consequential women in British political history. Why was that?
Asquith was absolutely besotted with her, deeply in love with her, relied on her as a sort of sounding board. He didn't like to take any decision, really, without talking to her. And so that she was up to speed, he sent her military secrets. And really, she was easily the most well-informed woman in Britain. And in the end, around the spring of 1915, about 6-7 months after the war had started, it all began to become too much for her. She eventually broke off the relationship with Asquith just as he was hit by a huge political crisis. And he seems to have lost his nerve and folded the government and invited the Conservative or the Tory opposition into a coalition government. And there was never to be a Liberal government in the United Kingdom again. And he wrote to her in a letter that's hardly rather been overlooked by historians and said, "I would never have taken this decision if I'd been able to talk to you. But for a period of about 5 or 6 days, because the affair had ended, he wasn't able to talk to her." So who knows what might have happened if the relationship hadn't broken down.
Well, that is extraordinary to think that she might have helped to bring down a government. On the other hand, one can hardly fault her. It's just such a fascinatingly detailed book. You really delve into the psychological motivations and, you know, contradictions of the characters. So tell us a little bit more about both of these, and let's start with Venetia Stanley.
Well, Venetia, at the outset of the book, is 26. She was the daughter of a former Liberal MP who had inherited a title on the death of his elder brother and become extremely rich. They have three huge properties, an enormous house in central London, a 64-bedroom mansion in Cheshire in northern England, and a castle in Wales. She was the youngest of the children by far and was rather left to roam on her own. She didn't get formal education, although she was bright and could speak French and German fluently. She was quite eccentric. She kept a pet bear, for example, bought it as a bear cub. Eventually it grew so large it used to chase guests across the lawn and had to be given away to London Zoo. She also kept a penguin on the coast in Wales, where the family castle was. She hung around with a fast set of friends, fashionable friends, who were known as the Coterie. And she was, I think, very flattered to have the attentions of the Prime Minister. And, you know, they used to go out for long drives together, an hour and a half, 2 hours around southern England every week. They'd take a weekly drive together, as well as meeting in country houses and in London at lunches and dinners. And she was a sort of free spirit. She was well connected. She was the first cousin of Winston Churchill's wife. She'd been a bridesmaid at their wedding, and she knew the Churchills very well. She knew everybody, really. And it was an eccentric intellectual family. Her father's elder brother, the one that died, had converted to Islam in the end of the Victorian era and sat in the House of Lords as a Muslim peer. And her other uncle, Algernon, was a Roman Catholic bishop. So they really had all ends covered. And her father was an atheist. And Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, was also one of her relatives. So she came from a highly intellectual family. She was very independent, free-spirited, and I think rather confined by the gilded cage in which she was born.
And now Herbert Asquith, I did a little reading about him, and he was responsible for some of Britain's first social welfare programs, but also was a fierce opponent of the women's suffrage. So tell us about him and the Liberal Party.
Yeah, well, he was a Victorian. He was born in 1852. He came from the north of England, from a not particularly smart family, but he had a brilliant intellect. He may well have been the cleverest man intellectually who's ever been prime minister. He went to Oxford. He became a lawyer. He rose to be Home Secretary and then Chancellor of the Exchequer and then took over as prime minister. And he presided over a period of turmoil in Britain. As you say, he introduced social legislation. He was responsible for the introduction of old age pensions in Britain. He was a reformer, but at the same time, he was a Victorian. And as you say, he opposed women's suffrage, like as Churchill did. He had a fondness for drink. Asquith was known as Squiffy or Squiff. He was quite often quite drunk. And he also had a great penchant for young women, the company of young women. He would nowadays be Me Too would have dealt with Asquith pretty quickly. He was notoriously unsafe in the back of taxis. But he was a brilliant man, and he was prime minister. The only prime minister longer than his term in the 20th century was Margaret Thatcher. He was a dominant figure.
So, of course, now the central focus of the book is the voluminous correspondence between Venetia Stanley and Herbert Asquith, which you have already referred to, Robert Harris. He wrote her every day, even several times a day. Now, the sharing of classified information, I think, is pretty shocking. You put it down to that he was dependent on her for kind of a sounding board. But talk a little bit about, you know, the psychology of somebody who could do something so incredibly reckless to the point that he was even tossing classified documents out of the car after he had spoken with her about them. And then, at least in your book, I'm not sure this actually happened, they would be found by passersby and were brought to the police stations.
No, all that is completely true. Asquith described it in a letter. These particular documents were telegrams from ambassadors abroad that had been encrypted, decrypted, and they were typed on carbon paper, the old onion skin typewriter paper, and circulated to only five men in the government: the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, Churchill, who was head of the Navy, Lord Kitchener, who was head of the Army, and the Colonial Secretary. So only five men had these. And he used to show his copies to Venetia when they were on these long drives. And having shown her what the ambassadors were saying in the run-up to the war, he would then screw them up and throw them out of the window. And in August 1914, when the war began, there was a great spy mania in the country about German agents. And passers-by, people on the street in the fields, found these and handed them into the local police. And eventually there was some kind of leak inquiry into what the hell was going on. Well, all five men, including Asquith, of course, denied being responsible. And that was another motivation for me to write the book, because I thought, well, there was a leak inquiry. Why don't I invent the intelligence officer who had to conduct it? And that, along with the, you know, imagining Venetia's replies to Asquith, gave me the basis of the novel. It was an astonishing breach of security. If you look at her papers in the library in Oxford, interspersed with them are letters from Kitchener, the war secretary, the commander of the British Army in France, intelligence estimates of German forces on the Western Front. I mean, a really remarkable amount of classified intelligence, which fortunately Venetia kept very secret. But if she hadn't, it really could have been very serious.
And now tell us about this intelligence officer, Paul Diemer. He is your, I believe, your one character that is wholly made up.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, these two characters and the world they live in is so remote to us now. This whole world, this settled society of great country houses, hundreds of servants, vast wealth, to a large degree, that went over the edge of the precipice as well in 1914. And I wanted to take the reader into it with a character we can sympathize with, that is an outsider who gradually starts to piece together what is going on. So I invented he starts off as a detective sergeant with Scotland Yard. He's transferred to Special Branch. And then when the war starts, he's moved into MI5, our security service, and that's how he starts to investigate this whole affair. He has a brother in the army. So when he discovers that one of the documents that Asquith genuinely sent to Venetia was the actual position of the British Army to which they were retreating in August 1914, well, it kind of gives him a motivation to really get to the bottom of the whole story. So that's the detective strand of the story.
So actually, I want to take a little step back for a minute to look at this wider picture as Britain is on the brink of the precipice of World War I. You've just talked about that old order, but the old order was not just in England. I mean, the old order was, you know, where the monarchs of the different countries, British imperialism, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Talk a little bit about how this society, how this culture actually did get into war over the assassination of the Archduke of Austria by someone from a little country. How did that lead to an entire world war?
Well, this is one of the things that's haunting and seems relevant to us today, I fear, how a small incident can suddenly drag all the world, major world powers, into a war. The Archduke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and his wife were shot by a Serbian terrorist in Sarajevo at the end of June 1914. For a time, it didn't look as though this would have any huge consequences. But then the Austro-Hungarian Empire issued an ultimatum to Serbia, which was almost impossible for a government to accede to. The Serbs were backed by their fellow Slavs, the Russians, and the Austrians were backed by the Germans, led by the Kaiser, the German Empire. The Russians had a treaty with France. And so suddenly, out of a clear blue sky, the hot summer of 1914, suddenly this defensive pattern of alliances suddenly began to accelerate towards the cliff edge. The Austro-Hungarians decided to invade Serbia. That brought the Russians in to defend them. Once Russia had mobilized, the French mobilized, and then the Germans decided to try and strike at France and knock them out of the war quickly before taking on the Russians. So suddenly, from nowhere, you had an enormous European land war. The British might have been able to sit it out, but the Germans' plan for defeating France meant that they had to invade Belgium. And we had a treaty with Belgium. And also, there was a general feeling we couldn't just stand by and let the Germans take over the whole of Europe. And so suddenly, there was this giant conflict. And it was such an enormous mechanized slaughter. It caused such disruption that, of course, it led to the Russian Revolution, which in turn fueled the rise of fascism and eventually the rise of Hitler, and of course the Second World War, which was essentially a refighting of the first with the same belligerents. And America entered the First World War in 1917, of course, because the German attacks on American shipping. So, you know, what goes over the edge in 1914 is really the old Victorian 19th century world, and what is born is the modern world with which, to a large degree, we're familiar now.
And draw out the comparison a little bit to what you see that is going on now. Are you referring to the Middle East?
Referring to the Middle East, referring to Ukraine. You can imagine now a flashpoint that could bring NATO into conflict with Russia. You can imagine a flashpoint that might bring Britain, America, and France into conflict with Iran. You have then China always waiting in the wings. You know, we cannot take for granted the fact that we haven't seen a major world war since 1945, we can't be certain that somehow one of these flashpoints, which seems so totally remote to us now, couldn't trigger a general conflagration. I hope it won't happen, but 1914 is a warning. The problems with which Asquith had to grapple, which are the backdrop of the novel, something like that could happen again.
And say more about what Asquith had to deal with. You know, as you said, he tried to make a coalition government. Why was he forced into that? And ultimately, why did his government fail?
Well, nobody knew what they were getting into in the summer of 1914. The general view, the cliche, was it will be over by Christmas. The war began in August. People thought the war couldn't possibly go on for a long time. The only person who disagreed, actually, was Lord Kitchener, who was brought in to be Secretary of State for War. He was the most famous general in the British Empire. And when he was asked how long the war would last, he said, it won't end before 1917. And he said, that's because we will need to raise an army of 2 million men to defeat the Germans. That will take us 3 years. So it will go on till at least 1917. And he also warned that it would be like the American Civil War, which cost between 600,000 and 700,000 lives, only on a bigger scale. In this, he was, of course, correct. Asquith tried to avoid war. Three quarters of the Liberal Party he estimated, were against fighting, and half the British cabinet too. But in the end, once Belgium was invaded, then people saw that their opinion changed and Britain entered the war. It had a very powerful navy. But the war, the casualties mounted and mounted. There was a stalemate on the Western Front, which turned into a massive killing ground. And the British tried to strike out to do something different. Churchill devised a plan to attack Turkey, the Dardanelles operation with the landings at Gallipoli. That, in the end, cost 110,000 dead and failed. And the shortage of ammunition for the British Army on the Western Front and the fiasco of the Dardanelles in the end brought about a political crisis. And Asquith had lost the woman he used to turn to every day. He sent her letters and every day wanted a reply. And that channel of communication was cut. And it does seem that he had a kind of temporary nervous breakdown. He probably would have had to invite the Conservatives in to a coalition at some point anyway, but he might not have done it in May 1915 and not in the circumstances he did. And this goes back to what you mentioned earlier, why I say Venetia was a very consequential woman in British history. Not many people have ever heard of her, but she, behind the scenes, she was immensely important.
And talking about Gallipoli, well, first of all, I'd like you to talk a little bit about Winston Churchill, who comes out here in the book. I mean, I think probably most people in the UK know this about him, but most Americans just think of Winston Churchill as a great hero of World War II. Not so much of a hero in World War I, at least not with this campaign.
Well, the great paradox of Churchill's career was that until the summer of 1940, and indeed for a little bit afterwards, he was regarded with great distrust, especially by the Conservative Party, but really generally across the country, for a kind of rashness of judgment and for a love of war, really. He was the right man at the right time in 1940, but in 1914, he was so belligerent, as described by Asquith, and as he himself, he wrote to Clementine Churchill and said, everything tends towards catastrophe. I am geared up and happy. Isn't it terrible to be made like that? But that's how he was. He was in charge of the Navy. It was a huge fighting force, and he wanted to use it. And he spotted this idea of landing in Turkey, which he thought could be done as a naval operation. But of course, it couldn't. It reminds me very much of Vietnam, the Dardanelles business. It starts off quite small and limited, and eventually you're just throwing more and more men at it in a desperate attempt to try and achieve your objective and avoid losing face. So, yeah, Churchill at this time is a brilliant, but seen as unstable and unsound in his judgment. And it was fascinating to write about Churchill aged 39, before he's the gruff, famous figure that we all know today.
And Venetia, since we don't have her letters to Asquith, do we know what she thought of the Gallipoli campaign? Because you say in this novel, Precipice, Robert Harris, you have her saying that sometimes it's better to accept the inevitable and cut one's losses. She is counseling Asquith to have the British withdraw from Gallipoli.
I think it's plausible that she felt like that. And Asquith certainly began to realize he'd signed off on a disaster. But what is astonishing for many people, I think, is that the crucial meeting where the Gallipoli, the Dardanelles operation was first laid out by Churchill at a meeting of what was called the War Council, he was actually in the middle of writing a letter to Venetia, which took him half an hour during the course of the meeting. I mean, we actually have that letter, and we can see that he cannot have been paying full attention to what was actually going on. And this is another reason why the affair is so extraordinary.
Yeah, pretty shocking. Not paying attention to what's going on.
No, well, this is, I mean, you know, one of the values of historical fiction, I think, is to just look back and see the way that rulers behaved in the past. And I fear that they don't change very much. You know, the phenomenon of the leader who's having an affair, who's distracted from his work because of it, That's not uncommon. And the whole business of blundering into wars and throwing more and more tens of thousands of men at the problem, that's quite familiar too. So it's always useful to remind oneself of looking back at the past and see the extraordinary thing that things that human beings are capable of.
And that's not the only theme when it comes to something like this. There's the theme of impunity, no consequences for the ruling class. You begin the book with an incident in which that happens. Certainly the fact that when Asquith was taken down, it was not because of his revelation of military secrets to Venetia. It was because of a controversy over the ammunition shortage. So talk about that theme of impunity.
Yeah, I think this is the reason why I needed to invent Paul Deemer, the detective sergeant, who in the end comes to discover what's going on and who expresses our astonishment. I mean, he finds himself involved investigating a riverboat disaster, which Venetia wasn't actually on the boat, but all her friends were. And that was a great cover-up, which shocked him. Then he is transferred to MI5. And as luck would have it, he is the one landed with investigating why these papers are being found all over the country. And that is blocked by the establishment. And he really is the common man. He's us in that position, seeing how people did at that time get away with things. There wasn't a lot of press exposure. One of the amazing things about Asquith, who was in charge of an empire of 450 million people in 1914, he could walk down the street unnoticed, unrecognized. People didn't know even what prime ministers looked like in those days. He traveled without a bodyguard. I mean, it's quite amazing. It was a different world, a world in which you could have affairs and you could rely upon people to be pretty discreet about them. Things didn't get into the newspapers, especially in this magic circle of a few thousand, maybe 10,000 people, immensely wealthy, who ran the country, went for weekends to country houses and so on. There was an awful lot of affairs and adultery that just went unreported in a way, I think, which would be completely unthinkable and impossible today.
Yes, but the rich are still getting away with impunity, as we can see when the Supreme Court of the United States gives an ex-president immunity for criminal acts.
And both our countries have had the fair share of philandering leaders in the past decade or so.
Well, it is just a fascinating book, Precipice. Robert Harris, thank you so much for talking with us.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Precipice is out from HarperCollins. You can find a link to an audio excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, the unlikely alliance of Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Giles Milton is a master at bringing history vividly to life. He's a best-selling author of 12 works of narrative history, and he's the writer and narrator of the acclaimed podcast series Ministry of Secrets. His new book, The Stalin Affair, is a spellbinding account of the unlikely alliance between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin in World War II. Let's dive right into our conversation with Giles Milton. Giles Milton, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me on the show.
The Stalin Affair, this was just a wonderful read. It's about the alliance between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. But why did you call it the Stalin Affair? Why focus on that one figure of this triumvirate?
Well, this was a very, very unlikely alliance, the alliance between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. Take Stalin, the dictator of the Soviet Union. He's known to have liquidated, you know, millions of his own subjects. And Churchill, particularly, for his entire political career, had not only detested Stalin, but had detested the regime that he stood at the head of. And so when Hitler invades the Soviet Union on June the 22nd, 1941, suddenly Churchill finds himself facing a choice, really. Should he come to the aid of the man that he's hated all his life? And he's not beat around the bush when he's talked about Stalin in the past. But the fact now is that he's got a choice, really, between Hitler and Stalin. Who's the worst of the two? And that night, he makes a broadcast to the nation, to the British Isles, saying that in this hour of need, we have to support Stalin because, if you like, he's the lesser of two evils. In the contest between two dictators, Stalin is less bad than Hitler. And of course, then for Roosevelt as well, I mean, America's going to enter the war later than Great Britain, but it's a pragmatic decision. Hitler is enemy number one, and therefore all the resources of America and Great Britain are going to be thrown behind Joseph Stalin.
The book actually opens with Nazi Germany's invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941. This actually came as a great shock to Stalin. Why? Why was he so surprised?
Well, 2 years earlier, Stalin and Hitler had done a deal. This was one of the most unlikely deals to have ever happened between the two dictators who also detested each other, but they'd made a pact, the infamous Nazi-Soviet pact, which allowed them essentially to carve up or begin carving up Europe. And they started with Poland. Hitler invaded the western half of Poland and grabbed that. And Stalin invaded the eastern part of Poland and swallowed that for the Soviet Union. And this, of course, was the outbreak of World War II. This is the point at which Britain declares war on Nazi Germany. But there are many people who are thinking this alliance is not going to last. These are just such improbable bedfellows, Hitler and Stalin, that it's going to fall apart. And sure enough, the warning signals begin to sound in the early summer of 1941, where there's a huge amount of intelligence to show that the Wehrmacht, the German army, is amassing on the border of the Soviet Union. Now, a lot of people tell Joseph Stalin what's taking place. He's getting intelligence from spies, from military sources. He's even getting it from Britain. You know, Churchill warns him, you're going to be invaded. But Stalin refuses to listen. He simply doesn't believe that Hitler is going to betray him, tear up the Nazi-Soviet pact and turn against him.
And what do you think that says about Stalin's character? You know, there are several times in the book where the naivete of these great historical figures, in this case Stalin, later on Roosevelt, and even I'd have to say with Churchill, is quite appalling. But then we have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. So why was Stalin so shocked at what Hitler did?
I think you're right that Stalin, or the three leaders, as you say, all displayed naivety, but Stalin's only really comes at this point, and I think he learns from his mistake. He didn't believe the intelligence he was given. He believed that, particularly when Churchill and the British told him, warned him that the Nazis were about to invade, he thought they were deliberately placing him in a trap, you know, so that he didn't believe what they had to say. What's very interesting is what happened in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, in the hours and days that followed, that Stalin had, if you like, an almost complete mental collapse, because he'd been assuring everyone, from everyone in the country, but also all his commissars, his inner circle, he'd be assuring them that Hitler wouldn't invade. And so when Hitler does invade, it's almost like he can't cope, and he retreats. He leaves Moscow. He goes to his dacha in the countryside, his country house, and he refuses to see anyone. He refuses to take any telephone calls. And for 4 or 5 days, he's there on his own, and no one can get hold of him. And eventually, a small group of his innermost commissars go to the dacha, and he thinks they've come to arrest him and shoot him. In fact, they've come to beg him to take control of the war effort, to assume control of the Soviet Union. And they persuade him, and Stalin agrees to return to Moscow, take charge of the war. And from that moment on, he becomes the war leader, one of the big three wartime leaders. But it's a peculiar event, and people have really struggled to explain how he had this complete mental breakdown, if you like. But I think it was because he genuinely didn't believe that Hitler would betray him and tear up the Nazi-Soviet pact.
And so he doubted his own capacity as a leader. In fact, he thought others would do to him what he would have done to them if he were in their position. Yes, and I think one of the aspects of genius of this book is your ability to get into the minds and the character of these leaders. So just give us a brief sketch. I mean, we all know Churchill and we know Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Stalin may be more of an enigma to many people, but, you know, most of us know something about them. What was your perspective on the inner drives, the inner character, the contradictions of these characters?
So, yeah, that's an interesting question, because what I tried to do with this book was almost, if you like, peek out from behind the curtain and eavesdrop on these three leaders, particularly when they're all together, but also when they're back at home discussing what on earth they're going to do in some of these crisis moments of the war. And I alighted on three characters who really, for me, were there at the heart of the war. They were there for all the big decision-making times. And they were Averell Harriman, a famous American businessman, multimillionaire, fourth richest man in America in 1941, head of the Union Pacific Railroad Company. And he was sent to London by Roosevelt to be Roosevelt's direct and personal emissary to Winston Churchill. And this meant, from the beginning of 1941 onwards, Averell Harriman was living either at 10 Downing Street in London with Winston Churchill and family, or at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country retreat. And Averell did not go alone. He went with his young daughter, Kathy, vivacious, highly intelligent, extremely competent young lady. And she would write hundreds of letters to her sister in New York describing life with the Churchills, life at the absolute epicenter of the war. And these are fascinating because you really are, with these letters, peeking out from behind the curtain. She was there for all the big moments, for, you know, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. She was there at Chequers with Winston Churchill in the room, describes it in great detail. So from these accounts, both by her and by her father, we have this wonderful intimate account of the great moments of the Second World War. And just very briefly, the third person who's going to be important is Churchill's emissary to Joseph Stalin, who is a man called Archie Clark Carr, who, like Harriman and his daughter Kathy, they're all going to be sent to Moscow, and they're all going to end up working with Stalin in the Kremlin for the rest of the war. So absolutely fascinating to get their accounts of working with Churchill, working with Stalin, and also seeing the big three wartime leaders together at the big conferences in Tehran and at Yalta.
And so let's take these leaders. I want to go back to my question, because, for example, one thing that really struck me is how much Roosevelt and Churchill really wanted to befriend Joseph Stalin once they had become committed to helping him, and that this became almost a personal rivalry between them for the affections of Joseph Stalin. Why was this, and what role did this play?
Yeah, it's one of the most peculiar aspects of this story. I mean, this was a very tortuous relationship, not just between the two Western leaders and Joseph Stalin, but between Roosevelt and Churchill, who didn't trust each other at all on many, many things. And you're right, they had this really odd sort of desire to befriend, to become best friends with, or better friends with Stalin than the other one. And so this manifests itself, first of all, in the summer of 1942, when Churchill thinks, well, I'm going to get one up on Roosevelt. I'm going to fly to Moscow by myself and go and meet him and try and sort of start building a friendship with him, which he duly does. And of course, it goes disastrously wrong at first, because Stalin insults Churchill. He's thoroughly disagreeable to him. But little by little, with the help of Archie, who I mentioned earlier, this British ambassador who's out there, with his help, they begin to cement a relationship. And this causes sort of great alarm bells, I think, for Roosevelt, who wants to do the same thing. And Roosevelt, of course, won't meet Stalin until the Tehran conference, where they all three of them meet together in 1943. But Roosevelt goes out of his way to try and meet Stalin in private, serve him cocktails in his own room, you know. So they are competing for the affections of Joseph Stalin. And to be honest, all those on the sidelines find this not only bizarre, but completely bewildering. And they say, are all these three people just completely needy people? And the weird thing is, I think, is they all needed each other and they knew it. And so, yes, you get these strangely competing rivalries.
So say more about that. So on the one hand, you could put it down to neediness, which is a kind of personality or character trait. But they, on the other hand, to say that they all needed each other, well, that's all about the historical moment that they were in. So talk about these different factors that were in operation, the personal and the political.
As the war went on, particularly, they were sort of courting Stalin more and more. And there was a very good political reason for that, is that Stalin's Red Army, you know, after the Battle of Stalingrad, began to advance into Eastern Europe and Central Europe. And both Roosevelt and Churchill realized that Stalin was the coming power, that when the war came to an end, Stalin was likely to be in charge of vast swathes of Eastern and Central Europe, including the Baltic states as well. And they realized that, you know, they were going to have to try and thrash out a deal with him. So even already at Tehran, but particularly at the Yalta Conference in February 1945, they're really sitting around a table with him, deciding the architecture of the post-war world. They're literally carving up the spoils of war. You know, who is going to get what? Because Stalin is in a position of absolute strength. Remember, by February 1945, not only are his troops in Bulgaria, Romania, all these countries, the Baltic states, but they've swept through Poland and they're knocking at the gates of Germany, you know. So the reason why they're sort of clamoring for his affections is because they think, you know, they need to do a deal with him and they want to do the best deal possible. Roosevelt, I should say, but displays extraordinary naivety at some of these conferences to the great dismay of his own advisors. So, for example, they talk about the Baltic states and, you know, he says, what's going to happen to the Baltic states? And Stalin says, you know, well, the Red Army will probably be in control of these by the end of the war, but we'll hold a plebiscite and see what the people want, you know. And Roosevelt says, yeah, well, that's a sort of jolly good, you know, thing to do. And as his advisors are all sort of shaking their heads in dismay, they say Roosevelt doesn't seem to realize that any plebiscite run by Joseph Stalin is likely to go the way of Joseph Stalin. And it wasn't just Roosevelt. Churchill, too, displayed enormous naivety when dealing with Stalin, who could certainly turn on the charm with these two leaders when he needed to.
Yeah, and in fact, of the three in your book, Giles Milton, in The Stalin Affair, Stalin is the one who comes off as being the most skilled negotiator of these conferences. I mean, to the contemporary witnesses, they thought, you know, if it were a debate, Stalin would have won.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And what makes it so interesting is to follow the people on the inside of this, you know, who, as I say, peeking out from behind the curtains, is there. They have a ringside seat to all this. So they're watching them in action. And they're constantly warning Washington and Whitehall, a British equivalent, they're constantly warning the diplomats that they're underestimating Stalin, that Stalin is treated sort of like a murderous gangster by Churchill and Roosevelt and others in the, you know, in the State Department. And what they say is, look, this guy is highly intelligent. He's extremely well-read. He's politically adroit. And you are making a big mistake by underestimating him. And so, you know, you get comments from both Averill and Archie Clark Kerr saying, yes, he's murdered millions of his own people. He's a horrible dictator. But we're in a wartime alliance with him and don't underestimate him. He is going to go for whatever he can get. And unfortunately, these warnings repeatedly fall on deaf ears. You know, so the White House, the State Department, Whitehall in London, they just don't want to listen to this message. And they continue to treat him like he's some sort of ignorant peasant to their own peril.
To their own peril. Yeah, so talk about that. Because on the one hand, their ability to make what seems, you know, a kind of genuine, I don't want to say pact or even friendship, but yeah, to a certain degree, a genuine relationship with Stalin, where Stalin himself seems moved at times by, you know, the consideration that is being accorded to him. I mean, that was crucial for the success of being able to work together to defeat the Nazis. But what was the peril?
Well, I think it's important to mention that Stalin, I think, always respected Roosevelt, but he didn't respect Churchill. He didn't particularly like Churchill. Why did he respect Roosevelt? Not for what he represented, because he obviously detested the American political system, but Roosevelt had the ability to supply the Soviet Union with vast quantities of weaponry. And this was a lot to do with Avril Harriman and Harry Hopkins. What they do is convert the entire industrial might of America into a weapons-producing machine. So all the great sort of automobile factories of Detroit are given over to making tanks, to making planes, etc. And a lot of this is being shipped over to the Soviet Union. And if there's a question of peril, I think it's that Stalin knows he needs this stuff. You see, if he's going to win the war on the Eastern Front, and this is a very desperate war that's taking place, you know, 3 million Wehrmacht troops, Nazi troops, have invaded the Soviet Union. This is warfare on a scale hitherto unimagined, really, in the history of warfare. And so Stalin desperately needs American machinery, American munitions. And so he has to stay on the right side of Roosevelt. And this is it's a very important aspect of the whole war, and it gets very little written about. And Avril Harriman, of course, is absolutely instrumental in finding a way of getting these millions and millions of tons of weaponry into the Soviet Union to save Stalin's skin.
So I want to go back, actually, to the peril of in Eastern Europe, to the domination, the post-war domination of the Soviet Union, because the issue of Poland, and this is during the war, the issue of the future of Poland comes up as a bone of contention between Winston Churchill, in particular, and Stalin, and with Roosevelt almost seeming to side with Stalin in the way that you spoke of before with the Baltic states. What happened, and fold into this discussion, into the conversation, the Katyn Forest, the massacre there?
So Poland is a very important element all of this, because it was because of Poland, the invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and by the Soviet Union, that Britain went to war. So for Churchill, it was an incredibly important part of everything. And of course, from the very beginning of the war, Britain, London, had played host to the Polish government in exile. So the Polish government flees Poland when it's overrun, comes to London and sets up a government in exile. And for Churchill, the whole, for the post-war structure of the world, he's absolutely insistent that Poland will have a democratic government. That's why Britain has gone to war, really. Stalin is absolutely insistent that Poland will have a government that says yes to Moscow. And so he sets up a rival government in exile in Moscow. And there's this wonderful discussion, and this gives a real insight, I think, into the brilliance of Stalin's manipulative qualities. So at one of the conferences, Churchill talks about how the issue of Poland is a matter of honour for me, which all sounds very grand and good. And Stalin turns to him and says, if it's a matter of honour for you, it's a matter of life and death for me. And that's just one instance of how Stalin's very brilliant, rather brilliantly turns all of these wonderful Churchill monologues on their head. Now, the question of the Katyn massacre, which I'm sure many of your listeners will be vaguely familiar with, at least, which was a massacre of tens of thousands of Polish officers at the outset of the war. And the question, the big question hanging over this massacre, is was it committed by the Nazis or was it committed by the Soviets? And it's unclear. And this is where Kathy Harriman plays a big role, actually, because she is sent with a team of investigators to try and work out, was it the Nazis or was it the Soviets? What later becomes apparent is this was a massacre orchestrated by the Soviets. It was not done by the Nazis. But they want to try and show that the Nazis had committed this atrocity. And so when Kathy gets to view all these corpses that are dug out of the ground, I mean, it's thoroughly horrible, these decomposing corpses of Polish soldiers, and she goes through them one by one, and the Soviets start pulling out letters and diaries from the pockets of these corpses, and all the evidence points towards the Nazis having committed this atrocity. And she and her fellow investigators they come down on the side of the Soviets. They say, yes, indeed, the Nazis committed this atrocity. What they didn't realise is all of this evidence has been planted on the corpses by the Soviets themselves. It's just such a fantastically cynical operation that they've taken part in to try and convince the investigators and the world that the Nazis committed this atrocity. But no, only later does it come out that, in fact, Stalin himself has ordered the execution of some 30,000 Polish officers, aristocrats, intellectuals, etc., who are then buried in the forest of Katyn.
And why did he do that?
Because he wanted to, his policy in having taken the eastern part of Poland was to liquidate, literally destroy the intelligentsia and the officer class of Poland. He wanted to reduce Poland, as did Hitler as well, to a peasant country run by German or Soviet overlords. It was as brutal and as cynical as that.
And so this comes around again toward the end of the war with the Warsaw Uprising. This is when the Soviet Union is on the banks of the Vistula, is that?
Vistula, yeah, indeed, yeah.
They're moving west, and the Polish underground, the partisans who are within Poland, within Warsaw, unleash their own uprising against the Nazis. Now, you would think that Stalin would support this because it would have made the job so much easier of his own troops than to continue their advance. But he didn't. What happened?
But he didn't. And this is another instance of the pure cynicism of Stalin. So what he does, he gets his own, the Polish government in exile, which is living in Moscow, he gets them to do a radio broadcast to the underground army, which is in Poland, is in Warsaw, sheltering out in cellars and basements, what have you. He gets them to broadcast saying now is the time for an uprising against the hated Nazis. The Soviet army, as you say, is on the banks of the river. Just they can almost see the tanks and planes of the Soviet army on the other side of the river. And so Stalin issues this thing, rise up, fight against your Nazi oppressors, drive them out of Warsaw, which is what they do. But no support comes from the Soviet army. The Soviets don't cross the river. They don't offer any artillery support. They don't offer any support whatsoever. And here we have, in Moscow, Avril Harriman for the Americans and Archie Clark Kerr for the British going into the Kremlin and begging Stalin to do something to help this uprising. They ask Stalin to allow planes to take off from Soviet soil, to bomb Warsaw, to help those involved in the uprising. Stalin refuses to do anything. Why? Because, and this is the sheer cynicism of the man, he wants the Nazis to kill as many of the Polish opposition in Warsaw as they can. So when he takes over Warsaw at the end of the war, he won't have to deal with all these troublesome Poles. They'll all be dead, killed by the Nazis. It's a kind of extraordinarily ruthless example of realpolitik, of getting what you want through sheer violence.
So another issue of contention between the three, Stalin, Hitler, and Roosevelt, was the assault from the West on the part of the Allies against the Nazis, what was called Operation Overlord. We know it more familiarly here in the U.S. as D-Day. Why was Churchill so reluctant to get this done? Stalin really was pushing for it, although at a certain point, when he started winning on the East, he wasn't so sure. And Roosevelt was almost kind of in the middle. What was going on here?
Yes, so from the very moment that the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, Stalin turned to Churchill and Roosevelt and said, look, if you really want to help me, launch an invasion against Nazi-occupied France. Begin the liberation of Western Europe now. That will help me enormously because Hitler will be fighting on two fronts. It'll take the pressure off the Eastern Front. Churchill throughout 1941, 1942 and 1943 was very reluctant. Why? Because he felt that they didn't have the men or the material, the weaponry, and certainly the boats that were going to take, you know, huge numbers, tens and hundreds of thousands of troops across the English Channel. It was the biggest logistical exercise, you know, ever undertaken. And a lot of this stuff was coming from America. All the landing craft, they were being built in America. They had to be shipped across the Atlantic to Great Britain before this could take place. Churchill knew perhaps even more than Roosevelt, that the Western Allies only had one shot at D-Day. They had one chance to do this. If they failed, it would be almost impossible to launch a second attempt. So he wanted to make sure that when it happened, it was going to be victorious. So for 3 years, they have Stalin kind of constantly sending telegrams and messages saying, launch this and now, we need help, we need relief on the Eastern Front. But as you say, and this is a really interesting turning point in the war, when Stalin realized he's winning on the Eastern Front and the Red Army is advancing into Eastern Europe and into Central Europe, suddenly he goes quiet on the Western Allies launching D-Day, because he's thinking, if they launch D-Day and they're very successful and they start advancing towards Berlin very quickly, we might have made a real fool of ourselves, because they might occupy territory that we could have, you know, quite easily occupied with the Red Army. So, of course, he goes quiet. But D-Day happens on 6th of June 1944. And, of course, actually, it takes the Americans, the Brits and the Canadians much longer than they thought to advance eastwards towards the German frontier.
Yeah, and in fact, it was the Soviet Union that took Berlin.
It was indeed. And this was the Stalin's great hope, was that the Red Army would take Berlin. And actually, I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with a very, very famous photo of the red flag flying over the Reichstag. And it was very interesting, because this was an instrument of propaganda that Stalin really wanted this photo to be sent around the world to show that the Soviets and the Soviets alone had taken Berlin. The photographer actually loved the photo of the, you know, the picture of the American soldiers on Iwo Jima raising the Stars and Stripes. Iconic photo of the 20th century. Stalin essentially said, I want a copy of that photo. I want one very similar, but I want it with a red flag on the Reichstag. So this was duly done. It was flashed around the world. It went on every front page of newspapers around the world. And it showed what Stalin wanted it to show, that he, the Red Army, had defeated Germany. He wanted to show that they defeated Germany and not the British and Americans. Again, another very devious ploy on his part.
Yes, but of course, he would not have been able to do that had it not been for the support of England and the United States. You know, I've often heard that the Allies would not have won the war without the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union was absolutely critical. But I think in reading your book, what gives me a real appreciation of how the course of history really depended on this kind of cooperation between erstwhile enemies and even enemies, people who became enemies after the war, that the cooperation was key. It would not have happened without England, without the United States, and without the Soviet Union, all of them. And what really struck me is how the personal relationships of these political leaders were absolutely critical in being able to bring that about. And the reason I think the lesson of your book is so important for us today is that at least here in the United States, we face a prospect of electing a former president who has absolutely no respect in the rest of the world, who would be absolutely incapable of accomplishing, with all their flaws, what Roosevelt, Hitler, and Stalin did in preserving a peace or winning a war.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, look at what Churchill said. He, one of his less well-known quotes, but I think a very pertinent one, he says, there's only one thing worse than fighting with allies, and that's fighting without allies. And so they realized that there was only one way that they were going to defeat Adolf Hitler, and that was to come together and forge an alliance. I call this an impossible alliance, or improbable alliance, whatever. But these three men, who after all had profound differences in politics, in everything, they didn't particularly trust each other, they didn't particularly like each other, they came together because they knew it was for the good of the world. And so they were able to bury their differences. It was difficult. It required the services of people like Averell Harriman to keep this alliance together. You know, it almost fell apart on a number of occasions. But I think at the end of the day, all three realized that they were not going to win without the three of them together. And particularly, you know, what America was able to bring to the Soviet Union. You're right, the war on the Eastern Front was absolutely crucial for victory in the Second World War. But would the Soviets have won it without the millions of tons of American lend-lease machinery and munitions that were shipped into the Soviet Union? Stalin, in private, said they wouldn't have done. He never said that in public. Now, of course, you know, winding forward to today, Putin, of course, has written Lend-Lease out of the history books. There is no mention these days in Russia of any American or British assistance to the Soviet Union during the war. And what's particularly shocking, and I'm sure will shock your listeners, is that statues of Stalin are being re-erected by Vladimir Putin across Russia. And even worse, the statue of Dzerzhinsky, who is the monstrous head of the Secret Service, which became the KGB, his statue, torn down in 1991, has just been re-erected in Moscow again. So we see history repeating itself. And I mean, you alluded to the elections coming up in America. I can tell you everyone in my country and Britain is terrified of Trump winning the election. And I've just come back from Berlin, actually. I was there for a few days. And everyone there is terrified of a Trump victory as well. So, yeah, we're all waiting very nervously for the result of that election.
The book is absolutely terrific, The Stalin Affair. Giles Milton, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a great pleasure.
The Stalin Affair is out from Macmillan. Read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.